Hey everybody. This podcast is sponsored by Smalls. If you are a listener to this show, you know that my cats enjoy Smalls, Sam's cat, Matt's two cats. We are all cat families around here, except Brian is a dog, so you're left out of this one.
Sorry.
But the three of us can attest that Smalls is amazing for our cats. To get 60% off your first order plus free shipping, head to smalls.com and use our promo code MAJORITY for a limited time only. Smalls cat food is protein-packed, and their recipes are made with preservative-free ingredients that you would find in your fridge, and it's delivered right to your door. That's why cats.com named Smalls their best overall cat food. When I was getting my new kitties, I was researching cats. You got to look up for the ones with real food. You just Google it. And I was like, huh, Smalls is a sponsor of ours. Let me check if they're on the up and up. And right away, you can tell Smalls' ingredients is really just the best in the business. If you're still not a believer, Forbes ranked Smalls the best overall cat food, while BuzzFeed said, my cats went completely ballistic for this stuff. And that is my experience as well. Matt, I know when you squeeze a little bit of that juice on the dry food, they really enjoy it. But they also have, you know, wet food for them, little snacks.
That you refrigerate.
Yeah. And so you can tell this is the good stuff. It's not, you know, it's not some of the cheapier stuff, let's be real. And honestly,
yeah, it's not the stuff you're picking up at the bodega
right
at 2 in the morning because you forgot to...
Right.
Buy Smalls and now your cats are yelling at you.
And we made a transition from some of the more, you know, processed stuff they were used to Smalls and to like the organic stuff. And first of all, they haven't been gaining weight as rapidly. It's been more, they look, you know, better. And their coat is much softer, which you notice. And their energy is better, which it's just great to see. And you kind of watch that happen in real time. Smalls also has a bunch of amazing treats and snacks you can add to your order. My cats love, I guess, like what was the little meaty bite one? I can't remember it, but either way, after switching to Smalls, 88% of cat owners reported overall health improvements. That's a big deal. And if you have a particularly picky cat, Smalls has a sampler so your cat can try everything that Smalls has to offer. And the team at Smalls is so confident your cat will love their product, you can try it risk-free. That means they will refund you if your cat will not eat their food. So what are you waiting for? Give your cat the food they deserve. For a limited time only, because you are a Majority Report listener, you can get 60% off your first Smalls order plus free shipping by using my code MAJORITY. That's 60% off when you head to smalls.com and use promo code MAJORITY. Again, that's promo code MAJORITY for 60% off your first order plus free shipping at smalls.com. In the show notes, you will see a link to this. Again, for a limited time only, get 60% off your first order plus shipping when you head to smalls.com and use code MAJORITY. And now, time for the show.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Thursday, September 4th, 2025. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Cedar, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, steps, from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Molly White of the Citation Needed newsletter will be with us to talk about Trump's crypto scams and efforts to deregulate. And later in the show, Greg Stoker of the Colonial Outcast podcast joins us. We just recorded this interview, so not exactly live, but somewhat live from the aid flotilla heading to Gaza.
In the Mediterranean.
Also on the program, HHS Secretary RFK Jr. is being grilled by a Senate panel as we speak. after firing the CDC director because she refused to go along with his anti-vax quackery. In Florida, the state announced plans to end all vaccine mandates for children, which experts warn could be a disaster for public health. I don't even know why we need to say that.
Where in the state where Disney World is?
Yeah.
Look, Google Disney World measles. I think it was measles. There was an outbreak of something there.
The U.S. job market slumped again last month. The U.S. now has more unemployed people than job openings for the first time since April 2021. Not good. Washington, D.C. sues the Trump administration over its military takeover of the city. Trump is now threatening to send troops to New Orleans because it's a blue city in a red state. He likes the governor, but not the mayor. Shocking. Estimates show that Trump's Chicago takeover costs four times as much as housing the city's entire homeless population. A judge orders the Trump administration to reverse billions in cuts to Harvard University. After extrajudicially bombing a boat coming from Venezuela, the Trump administration is ending temporary protected status for a quarter of a million Venezuelans. Trump turns to the Supreme Court to quickly reverse the tariff ruling that deemed his tariff regime illegal.
I get to do tariffs because Canada is flooding us with fentanyl.
You gotta let me. Did you hear Canada recognize a Palestinian state? Isn't that an emergency?
It's a lot fair if you don't let me pretend that Canada is flooding us with drugs in order for me to do tariff stuff.
Israel kills at least 62 Palestinians over the past 24 hours as the IDF moves further into Gaza City. And lastly, Trump asked the Supreme Court to reverse the verdict in the civil suit that found that he sexually abused E. Jean Carroll. It's a great use of our highest court's time.
Hey, can you do me a salad?
Yeah.
John?
People are calling me a rapist because of all of the evidence. Can you stop that?
Can you take that off my permanent record?
All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the show, everybody. It is an M Majority Report Thursday, and we are actually sans Brian. He had to jump for an appointment, and so it's just myself and Matt today. So if we're taking a second to pull up some clips, bear with us, but hello to Matt. I think it's good. Just the two of us. It's going to be fine.
I know you're expecting me to say it's horrible. Well,
I know it sounds horrible, but it's good. So, I'm getting some IM saying that the women from the I've Had It podcast were quoting me on their show today, which that sounds pretty good.
Oh my God, that's awesome.
Love those ladies. We're hoping to collaborate with them in the future, so stay tuned on that. But
shout out Oklahoma City.
Shout out. So, right now, as we're live here, the CDC, Health and Human Services Secretary, RFK Jr., is being grilled by a Senate panel because last week, Trump, you know, working alongside RFK Jr., fired Susan Menares, who was the CDC director, who had just been confirmed like a month ago. And she was fired, and then four other CDC officials resigned in protest and in solidarity with her. And this is just like the latest horrific action that RFK Jr. has taken to kind of purge the CDC of anybody sane and with a scientific or medical background.
It's appalling that he has any say in this at all, and that like this isn't just he's just not some sort of figurehead that and they let like the actual people who aren't lunatics run it, and that he's actually, you know, giving recommendations to remove people is lunacy.
And he was confirmed, by the way, by this senator who was about to grill him, Bill Cassidy. Remember this? There was all this like talk of, well, maybe some Republicans will stand up to Donald Trump and block this absolute lunatic conspiracy theorist, obvious charlatan to anybody who understands public health. Well, we'll have Cassidy here who will stand up because he's a doctor.
Yeah, and I mean, I remember a lot of people from maybe like sort of not explicitly partisan folks were hoping that Cassidy would show some sense, and unfortunately all those people were gravely disappointed because of the nature of the Republican Party.
Right. Although I do think it's notable that even some Republicans are grilling him in this hearing. From what I'm, you know, prepping for the show, I can't see everything, but it's an indicative of the tides turning a bit.
And Cassidy is up for re-election in 26.
Yeah. And so he's got to be concerned about that. In the same way that all of the House Republicans have to be concerned in the other chamber about the Epstein stuff. You know, who's going to go against Trump, but who's going to sign on to this discharge petition? Because there's growing momentum with Boebert saying yes, Marjorie Taylor Greene saying yes, Thomas Massey. It's putting these Republicans who in the House, of course, they're all up for re-election in 2026. It's putting them in an uncomfortable position because I think that issue, it's not going to motivate people to turn out, I think, against you.
Demoralize your
voters.
But
it demoralizes the base of people that thought that the Republicans cared about Epstein and sex trafficking. Laugh along with me. But it is like a bit of a...
There's a non-trivial part of the coalition that turned out to vote because they thought they were electing Liam Neeson and Taken.
Exactly. And we want those votes depressed. Some of them may turn and vote for Democrats, but majority of them are not going to. And it's just important that they that it's on display for them that their representative is a piece of garbage who actually is lying to them the entire time. So Bill Cassidy is trying to, you know, stave off a potential, challenge. And he's in the red state, obviously, but it still could happen. It's crazier things have happened. There was a Democrat elected in Alabama in Trump 1.0,
around this time,
Jeff Sessions.
We started ramping up for that.
Exactly.
Campaign.
So, crazier things have happened, but here he is, challenging RFK just earlier this morning.
Mr. Secretary, do you agree with me that the president deserves a Nobel Prize for Operation Warp Speed?
Yeah, absolutely, Senator. That's phenomenal.
Let me ask you. But you just told Senator Bennett that the COVID vaccine killed more people than COVID.
Whoopsie.
Wait, that was a statement.
I did not say that.
Okay, then let me ask, because you also...
Senator, I just want to make clear, I did not say that.
We'll check the record. That's a question of fact. You also said that you were also, as lead attorney for the Children's Health Defense, you engaged in multiple lawsuits attempting to restrict access to the COVID vaccine. Again, it surprises me that you think so highly of Operation Warp Speed when, as an attorney, you attempted to restrict access.
Okay, can you pause for a second? Can RFK not breathe so heavily into the microphone via his nostrils? Like, I've never heard a Senate hearing in this way where the guy is literally, I mean...
Sounds like he's in an iron lung.
Exactly. I guess those, you know, gene workouts aren't really helping his lung capacity right now. My God. That's a trivial point, but we will be correcting the record. Let's keep going. We have the actual video that Cassidy is referencing, an infamous interview with Lex Fridman, but keep going.
You also said that you were also, as lead attorney for the Children's Health Defense, you engaged in multiple lawsuits attempting to restrict access to the COVID vaccine. Again, it surprises me that you think so highly of Operation Warp Speed when, as an attorney, you attempted to restrict access.
Well, let me ask. I'm happy to explain why.
I have 3 minutes and 30 seconds left.
He's happy to explain why. Bunch of mealy mouth stuff, I would guess, because it's pretty funny to say, because you're sucking up to Donald Trump in such an obvious, sloppy way. Get off your knees, buddy.
His tactic is to retreat into know-nothingness, yep. Which is like, I couldn't say that vaccines killed more than COVID because you can't trust any of the data.
Right.
Like, that's his actual response.
But here is what Cassidy was referencing early on. This was him back in 2023, what he had to say about vaccines.
Anti-vaccine, your pro-safe vaccine. Difficult question. Can you name any vaccines that you think are good?
I think some of the live virus vaccines are probably averting more problems than they're causing. There's no vaccine that is, you know, safe and effective.
Those are big words. What about the polio? Can we talk about the polio?
Well, here's the problem. Here's the problem.
Yes.
Here's the problem. The polio vaccine contained a virus called simian virus 40, SV40. It's one of the most carcinogenic materials that is known to man. In fact, it's used now by scientists around the world to induce tumors in rats and guinea pigs in labs. But it was in that vaccine, 98 million people who got that vaccine.
Okay.
So the polio vaccine is not an example of a safe and effective vaccine. In fact, he never gives one.
He never gives one. The polio vaccine all but eradicated polio, although we are seeing a bit of a resurgence. Same thing with measles. There was this SV40 that contaminated polio vaccines in the 50s and 60s, but since then, vaccines have been free of SV40 because of government regulations. It's the same tactic he uses when he's talking about thimerosal in vaccines, which has not been in these childhood vaccines that he spoke about since, what, the early 2000s they took it out because of these concerns, and it showed no effect on autism rates.
Yeah, its removal had no effect. So just move on to the next thing. And it's the same thing with the American, you Google RFK American Samoa, where they were peddling anti-vax stuff, and there was, I believe, a measles outbreak there that killed kids. And then all of a sudden, RFK is like, well, don't look at me. I'm just, you know, the humble asking questions guy. Like, there's a complete cavalier lack of responsibility and accountability by this guy as he causes massive medical harm.
He is not interested in health in the way that a doctor would be or that a public health official would be, because it's inherent in his rhetoric and things like what we played last week, where he talks about how he walks around the airport and sees these disgusting children with mitochondrial inflammation or whatever garbage he's... Mitochondrial what? Deformities? Yeah. I forget exactly how he said... what the second word was, but like... Basically saying that he's diagnosing these children from afar, that he feels either that they are disabled, obese, or he can see into their soul or something like that. And his vision of health comes from a place of disgust. And
aristocracy.
Aristocracy. It's how a rich guy thinks about health, which is that if you just work out in this way or eat the right things, which I'll always have access to, or have the right supplements that I'll always have access to, then you can be as healthy as I am. And if you're not, well, what is the natural conclusion of that? You are a degenerate or you're not strong enough. And then you peel back the layers of this, and it's very easy to see how it's borderline eugenicist.
Yeah.
Because what is going to happen in Florida if they get rid of all childhood vaccine requirements? What's going to happen to disabled children? What's going to happen to children with autoimmune issues? Like, these children will die.
Kids are going to die, especially poor kids.
And so it's right. This is an exacerbation of the worst parts of our healthcare system by eliminating the infrastructure around public health and making healthcare so individualized that only folks with the right income can provide healthcare for their kids. I mean, this destruction of also the recommendation guidelines for the COVID vaccine, like if you don't have health insurance and you don't have some sort of pre-existing condition that can qualify you for access to the vaccine, it'll be like the early days of the mRNA vaccine where you needed to have a condition to get it before, if you were within like the healthy age range. Basically, this is going to make it so that more people die of COVID and it spreads further.
Remember when this was supposed to be about choice and now they're removing that choice?
Exactly.
To do it. And this might seem uncharitable to folks who, you know, RFK is one of the more popular figureheads in Trump's coalition. He's against Medicare for All because he is worried that the amount of money that he's inherited, he would have to spend it on taxes to pay for your sick ass. Like that's the filter he takes all this stuff through, at least lately. Maybe he wasn't like this 15 years ago. But when he comes out against single payer healthcare, he talks about how sick and obese people are because, and that is him doing the calculations of cost. Now, we know that actually it's really expensive to have this private healthcare system where we pay middlemen like at Universal Healthcare or whatever, United Healthcare, to like, you know, deny people coverage. But the rich people that are against public health in general and, you know, universal health coverage in particular are doing it because of pocketbook reasons, and they don't care. When he says he deserves the... It might seem like a contradiction, and he is insane, so who knows? But the contradiction between Trump deserves a Nobel Peace Prize for Operation Warp Speed, which made these vaccines, and him saying vaccines are actually really harmful and you don't know how many people they actually killed, is because he doesn't mind if certain people die, because he's basically a Malthusian psycho.
Also, I mean, didn't he also... When he talked about bird flu, it's exactly what you're saying. Remember when the initial thought was that it should just run through the population and then it'll be fine? He thinks that way about human beings.
Yep.
The weak, like, survival of the fittest as public health policy, which is the opposite of public health policy.
The thing he said about autistic people not paying taxes.
Yeah.
Insane. Like, this is an insane guy who's ultimately looking at his bottom line. It's not looking at healthcare.
That's how he got pretty rich in recent years, was suing vaccine manufacturers and exploiting the anxiety that parents feel about healthcare for their children and healthcare in general, because it's so difficult to access. So everybody who isn't wealthy feels anxious about it, and says basically, follow my guidelines and your child won't be this disgusting autistic or disabled person that I have no interest in helping, but have an interest in kind of doing away with via federal policy.
And it's a wider thing than RFK or even Trump. Ron DeSantis is, like we've been talking about, doing it down in Florida and then saying we're doing this because of medical choice. The same party that overturned Roe versus Wade and has been criminalizing women's right to choose.
Exactly. In a moment, we are going to be speaking to Molly White of this Citation Needed newsletter about Trump's just crazy crypto corruption. But first, a word from some of our sponsors. When the Majority Report started, I know that it gave Sam a ton of anxiety about thinking about doing a merch store. You know, developing that infrastructure from the ground up is really difficult. It can be super overwhelming. I mean, we have our issues. You know, we got to film the show, you got to record, you got to read and research, and it's just a lot to deal with. But when you find the right tool that helps you grow your business and helps you out and simplifies everything, it can be such a game changer. And for millions of businesses, that tool is Shopify. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world, from household names like Magic Spoon to brands that are just getting started. Shopify has hundreds of ready-to-use templates that help you build an online store to match your brand, whether that's beautiful, edgy, or minimalist. Shopify is packed with AI tools that help you put together product descriptions, page headlines, and even enhance your product photography. And best yet, Shopify helps you with managing inventory, international shipping, processing, returns, and beyond. If you're ready to sell, you're ready for Shopify. So our merch store, you love it? You love some of our merch? Well, that's made possible by Shopify. It just made it super easy for us. This is not a show that is business first, I would say, focused much on having to make things efficient and making money.
I mean, if we are, we're not doing a great job at it.
Yes. And so it's basically about ease, comfort, and being able to just like have a quick fix. And Shopify is more than a quick fix. It runs it really well for us. So thanks for Shopify for taking this off our plate. Turn your big business idea into cha-ching with Shopify on your side. Sign up for your $1 per month trial and start selling today at shopify.com/majority. Go to shopify.com/majority, shopify.com/majority, and we will put this below in the podcast and video description and show notes, shopify.com/majority. And lastly, this episode is sponsored by Liquid IV, as is basically every episode of the Majority Report, because we're all drinking it around the office. We are now back to school. Summer's winding down, but it is still hot in many parts of the country in the fall. And also, you have to be hydrated no matter the temperature. So as you're transitioning from summer shenanigans to the focus needed in the fall, you're going to need to ditch the glitch with zero sugar and zero crash from Liquid IV's new energy multiplier, sugar-free hydrating energy. It's scientifically formulated to support physical energy, hydration, focus, mood, and social stamina. Visit liquidiv.com and use code MAJORITYREP at checkout for 20% off your first order. Liquid IV is essential. I brought it for some of my bridesmaids at my wedding, thinking like, oh, you might need this in the morning. But also because we were doing so much throughout the day, kept us hydrated. I use it all the time when I'm traveling, when it's really hot out as well. And there's so many different flavors that you can choose from. The new sugar-free hydrating energy is perfect for the fall. The hydrating energy one helps you kind of just avoid some of the slumps in the afternoon when you're not feeling so energized. Just one stick, 16 ounces of water added to it, and it hydrates better than water alone. Powered by Live Hydroscience, an optimized ratio of electrolytes, essential vitamins, and clinically tested nutrients that turn ordinary water into extraordinary hydration. It has 8 essential vitamins and nutrients, always non-GMO, vegan, gluten-free, dairy-free, and soy-free. Ditch the glitch with zero sugar and zero crash from Liquid IV. Tear, pour, live more. Go to liquidiv.com and get 20% off your first order with code MAJORITYREP at checkout. That's 20% off your first order with code MAJORITYREP at liquidiv.com. Link below in the YouTube description and episode description and blog. Quick break. When we come back, we'll be joined by Molly White. We'll be right back. We are back, and we are joined now once again by Molly White, crypto and tech industry researcher and publisher of the Citation Needed newsletter, which I really encourage people to subscribe to if they want to stay updated on all these corrupt crypto shenanigans. Molly, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. So earlier this week, the Wall Street Journal reported that the Trump family got as much as $5 billion in paper wealth. That's how the journal describes it, but I'd love to for you to explain what that means. Because their crypto, you know, venture basically had the equivalent of an IPO earlier this week and like basically opened up. And the Trump family has a quarter of all World Liberty Financial tokens that are in existence. And so they made billions of dollars this week. How did that all happen?
Yeah, so the Trump family launched a project called World Liberty Financial some time ago. And they issue a token, WLFI is the token, that was originally meant to just be, it's called a governance token, but essentially it's not worth anything. You just use it to vote on the future of the platform and so on. It was originally very locked down. There was no secondary trading. It was only available to accredited investors or people who are outside of the U.S., largely because at the time, this was in the previous administration, the SEC was much more active in policing unregistered securities offerings. And so I think they were largely trying to dodge any issue with the SEC, seeing it as a unregistered securities offering, which was how they were viewing a lot of crypto tokens at the time. Since then, under Trump, the SEC has dramatically backed off from enforcing cryptocurrency-related cases. They've made statements to the effect that most cryptocurrencies are not securities. And so the World Liberty Financial Project has changed the design of the token essentially so that it is now available for secondary resale. And that was essentially what caused the windfall earlier this week, was now that that token is resaleable and there is sort of a market price for it because it's being actively traded, the large amount of that token held by the Trump family now has this paper price of, you know, several billion dollars. And now the Wall Street Journal is careful to describe it as a paper price because the issue with a lot of crypto tokens is that if one holder holds a substantial quantity of those tokens, they can't necessarily cash out at that amount. You know, the token price is largely based on supply and demand. And so if there was this sudden influx of supply with the Trumps, you know, dumping their entire holdings, they would not be able to cash out likely anywhere near that many, you know, five billion or 6 billion or whatever the number is going around.
However, they would. It still is a multi-billion-dollar windfall. Just want to emphasize that, even right. though, like the as you mentioned, it's the valuation. It's not going to be reflected if they were to cash out. Like when you talk a little bit about the tokens themselves. Like, is there any statutory regulation that prevents some of these like exchanges or currencies from printing more? I know that to do so would like dilute, say, the value of the folks who got in initially. But I could also see circumstances in which that would be beneficial for people and it would just screw over the regular, you know, Reddit investors or day traders of cryptocurrency.
Yeah, the retail.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so it really depends on the project. It's really up to less the exchanges and more World Liberty Financial, the company itself, whether or not they would issue more tokens. They have at various points done so. So there was an early allocation of tokens. The amount sort of changed a little bit throughout that process. There was early, like they had challenges meeting demand or finding demand early on. And so the number really moved around a lot. They've since issued more of those tokens for sale. So I think there is, you know, a substantial possibility that that could happen.
But it's just, was, I remember the arguments about cryptocurrency being that there was a finite amount, or at least maybe that's just particular to Bitcoin. Like, what then if there is the ability for the more coins or whatever to be printed, doesn't that undercut the central argument about cryptocurrency being an alternative to regular currency, because their critique of that was, oh, you could just print more money?
Yeah, so you're totally right that that is a major selling point for Bitcoin specifically, which does have a hard cap at the amount of Bitcoins that will ever be circulated. That's not so much the case for other cryptocurrencies. So there are major cryptocurrencies like Ethereum or Solana, which do not have that finite cap. And they do have to grapple with that issue that, you know, they could theoretically print, you know, infinite crypto tokens and cause the price to go to zero, essentially. There are different mechanics in which blockchain projects try to, you know, get around that. And we've seen the World Liberty Financial Project already experimenting with that throughout or in recent days, where they have begun, it's called burning tokens, where it's essentially destroying tokens that have already been issued to do the reverse, you know, to reduce the supply and hopefully increase the demand. So that's already been happening as the World Liberty team is trying to sort of pump the price of the token, quite frankly.
Right.
And so I think that is, you know, the type of activity we'll be seeing going forward.
Well, it's also, I mean, even if they don't cash out and sell all of their cryptocurrency for hard cash, they can they use this money or like their holdings here to, say, get like favorable loans and borrow against it in the way that Elon Musk purchased Twitter, or for example, this is how really wealthy people make their right. money is like they don't even cash out. They just use it as a leverage point.
Yeah, I mean, that is frankly my biggest concern with these types of projects, is that they are not necessarily going to sell all of their assets, but they will borrow against them. That was a major cause of the most recent crypto crash in 2022 or so. Certainly there were other aspects as well, but the amount of leverage in the system was what caused it to crash so dramatically and so quickly, I would say, is that, you know, assets being loaned out, reduced in value, people defaulted on the loans, that caused the assets to be sold at fire sale prices, the price went down, and it's sort of this vicious cycle where that degree of leverage in the system can spiral very, very quickly. And especially in crypto, where there is very dubious pricing, a lot of the due diligence by lenders is extremely shabby. A lot of it is sort of reputation rather than the quality of the assets. I think there is an enormous amount of risk, especially with projects like this, where, you know, the tokens have sort of dubious resale value. You know, it's a lot tied to sort of the Trump reputation.
Right.
And so I think that's going to be the question. I mean, a lot of traditional lenders do not lend against cryptocurrency. And so it's not likely that the Trumps are going to go out and get a bank loan against these assets. But there is this proliferation of lending in the crypto world, which is generally lending against existing assets, such as World Liberty Financial tokens. And I could definitely see them trying to take advantage of that.
How is that possible then? Is this lending kind of infrastructure completely like below the surface? I mean, how can cryptocurrencies, I don't know, operate in this way? I thought we had banking regulations that kind of made it so these banks were the main show in town.
We did.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, a lot has changed in the regulatory worlds when it comes to crypto. A lot of these crypto lending projects clinics either moved outside of the United States or shut down. In recent years, the SEC brought cases against crypto lenders. We saw Gemini, Coinbase shut down lending products because of the regulatory problems around these types of offerings. But now they've opened right back up. You know, they've started offering loans to U.S. customers, and the regulation is largely non-existent, especially as there is this ongoing question of who the primary regulator even is. And, you know, the SEC has essentially taken a step back and said, we don't know who it is, but it's not us.
Yeah, you wrote about that. Let's talk about that a bit, if you don't mind, Molly. Just like how the Trump administration has been, you know, decimating the regulatory agencies across all different bodies and sectors. But what I wasn't aware of until I was reading your reporting is that they have been trying to make it so that the Commodity Futures Trading Commission is, one, the only regulator for the cryptocurrency industry, and two, is just basically a single commissioner at this point that is obviously going to be handpicked by the president. Why does the crypto industry want this? And what is happening really behind the scenes with these regulatory bodies that our audience should know about?
Yeah, so there has been legislation already going through Congress that would, it wouldn't necessarily make the CFTC the only regulator, but they would become the primary regulator. And this is something the crypto industry has been pushing for years. They've for a long time, they've wanted the SEC out of the game as the crypto regulator, even though they were sort of the primary regulator for a while.
Can I pause you and ask why? Is that because the SEC just has way more investigative power?
Right. It has a lot to do with resources and sort of investigative ability. The SEC was, and frankly, the also the sort of stance that the SEC was taking under its previous chair, Gary Gensler. The SEC was willing a couple of years ago to take enforcement actions against cryptocurrency companies and did so in a fairly aggressive way, especially following the 2022 collapse and the FTX collapse. You know, they started to step in and say, okay, clearly, you know, there's something going wrong here. And they started opening enforcement actions. That was horrifying to the crypto industry, which went on a full scale sort of assault back against the SEC. And they've, you know, really lobbied for the CFTC to be put in as the regulator. It's a much smaller agency. It receives much less funding. It has much less experience regulating retail markets, frankly, whereas the SEC is, you know, the retailer or the regulator for, you know, retail stocks and things like that. And so it would likely be fairly toothless in comparison to the SEC.
Are they resting this on the idea that it's a commodity and not in some way a financial like asset, which is that the core of the argument? I don't understand how you could say that this is outside of the SEC's purview, except for the obvious corruption we're talking about. But like it stretches credulity even on its face.
Well, I mean, the CFTC is a financial regulator. You know, they regulate some aspects of the financial system, and it's sort of a split. You know, the U.S., unlike some countries, does not have sort of a single financial regulator. We have this split system. And so there are legitimate arguments that can be made that, you know, various cryptocurrencies maybe are commodities, or that various types of activities that people do with crypto trades should be handled by the CFTC. Frankly, I don't buy the argument that, you know, I largely agree that most crypto assets are securities and should be regulated by the securities regulator. Some in the crypto world have argued that no, they're not. Some have argued that, well, maybe, but these are outdated regulations that were written in the 1930s and we need something totally new. We need to carve out crypto from that regulation and put it into its totally new stage. So, you know, there are arguments that are being made. But frankly, I think a lot of it boils down to sort of a strategic decision to have the much weaker regulator in place. Although at this point, with the SEC very much changing direction. I sort of wonder if that was even necessary because mm-hmm. the SEC is also undergoing challenges around its willingness and ability to go after clear securities violations. But, you know, as you alluded to earlier, I think they are looking forward to this future where not only is the weakest regulator in charge of overseeing this quite large new sector that they previously did not have to oversee, but they would not necessarily receive increased funding to do so. We've seen crypto companies come out and say, we want the CFTC to take on this entire new industry, but also receive no support to do so. And then we've also seen, yeah. And then there's also the leadership issue, which is that, you know, the CFTC operates with a 5-person commission. It's normally somewhat bipartisan in that there are rules saying that no more than 3 commissioners should come from the same political party. The commission has already lost a number of commissioners just through resignations. We were down to 2 commissioners, the acting chair and one other. The remaining non-chair commissioner has just resigned this week, or rather her resignation took effect this week. So we currently have 1 CFTC commissioner who is the acting chair. She has stated that she plans to resign when Trump's nominee for chair is installed. So we would still have just the 1 chair on the commission. Trump has shown no interest in nominating additional commissioners to
the regulatory body that his family just made $5 billion off of.
Right. And, you know, I think there is sort of an unanswered question around, you know, can the CFTC operate with a single commissioner? Is that even allowed? But, you know, it seems like that may be the way that Trump is hoping to go, is to really install someone who is, you know, very much aligned with his agenda and leave the rest of the seats empty so that there's just sort of a yes man in charge of this nominally independent agency.
I think that there was some confusion about the Genius Act because there was like supposed bipartisan support, and you had Kirsten Gillibrand come out there with, I forget which Republican senator, and was saying how this is so important and we have to come together. Where when you look into the regulation in the Genius Act, it is basically about taking cryptocurrency outside of the SEC's purview, where it has stronger regulatory enforcement and just way more resources, and doing exactly this. Although, you know, this honestly was enabled in a bipartisan way, and that's because of the influx of crypto money into this last election. It was, I think, you know, the biggest sector that spent, or the second biggest sector that spent, you can correct me on that. And they took out a long-serving senator who was quite popular in his state, and Sherrod Brown. And so now you have like guys like Ossoff down in Georgia, who's up in 2026, signing on to this thing because they're all panicked about crypto money in their race.
That's absolutely right. I mean, I think the crypto industry was very strategic in how they spent across political parties, so that they have Democrats in office who are full tilt supporters of the cryptocurrency industry. They've also shown this willingness to spend, you know, regardless of political affiliation, if you get on board with the crypto agenda. And they have, I think, terrified a lot of Congress people that if they don't sign on, or at least shut up about the crypto lobby and its various regulatory and legislative goals, then they will be essentially taken out of office through massive spending in the midterms. This was the strategy they used in 2024, where they made some very early, large contributions to primaries of people like Katie Porter, who was seen as an opponent of the industry, Cori Bush, Jamal Bowman. And, you know, they were able to later point to those victories essentially in getting those people out of their primary races and say, look, we can do this to them, we'll do it to you. So, you know, basically get on board, support our legislation, sign on to our agenda, and you'll be safe. And I think that's what we're going to be seeing into the midterms, although there has been somewhat of a shift where it does seem like some of the crypto, at least the financiers, are also more interested in going explicitly partisan this time around because they are concerned about losing the Republican majority, which has been their strongest backers thus far.
The other piece I wanted to ask you about, just back to the Trump family for a second, because I was not aware of this until I was reading your reporting, that Donald Trump Jr. is apparently closely associated with Polymarket, the betting platform that now like allows you to bet on anything from how far the California wildfires will spread to how far or how long it will take to get a ceasefire in the genocide in Gaza to, you know, little things like internet rumors about this show taking money from the Democratic Party, which there was a bet on that.
Really?
Wasn't true. Yeah, it was pretty funny. We had a laugh about that. But underneath how, like, absurd it is the idea that you can bet on elections. Okay, like, I'm a sports fan. It's already insane that you can bet on the color of the Gatorade that's going to get dumped on the coach when they win the Super Bowl, because obviously someone could have inside information about that, let alone what the scandals we're seeing in sports about players who are maybe, you know, not paid as highly, leaving the game with an injury, and then suddenly they're making money, or their friends are making money, because this is the kind of thing this incentivizes.
Right.
Donald Trump Jr., you reported this, is a strategic advisor to Polymarket. He, after his father won, he went and joined this venture capital firm as a partner that is invested in Polymarket itself.
Yep.
And this, they're trying to basically get full access to the U.S. market. So they could be having literal financial speculation on the outcome of elections, so that folks could not just stand to make, rich guys could not just stand to make money on elections by buying our politicians in a corrupt way, which we already know about, but they could literally be financially incentivized to rig elections. And his son is invested in Polymarket, and Trump has a history of trying to undemocratically overturn elections. Like, this is a five-alarm fire.
I would even add to that, Donald Trump Jr. is also a board member on Kalshi, which is a competitor to Polymarket and is a very similar platform. Not only that, today, I think, or maybe yesterday, the CFTC issued a no action letter towards Polymarket, saying essentially, come on in, you know, come, allow U.S. customers to bet on your platform, despite the fact that the CFTC had issued or had taken an enforcement action against Polymarket several years ago. There were ongoing investigations by both the CFTC and the Justice Department into Polymarket that were stopped shortly after Trump took office. Trump's nominee for the CFTC chair, and the CFTC already is the primary regulator for events contracts, which is these prediction markets, essentially. So that's already established in the regulatory world. Trump's nominee for CFTC share is a major shareholder and board member on Kalshi, which is a prediction market. There was a FOIA request into emails sent by Trump's nominee to the CFTC after he received the nomination, suggesting that he may have been improperly requesting information on competitors to Kalshi, that he may have had some influence in the very friendly shift at the CFTC towards these prediction markets. So that entire realm of the industry right now is just incredibly corrupt and incredibly problematic and poised to make an even stronger entry into the United States.
Is there the opportunity to challenge this legally? I mean, I like, as if our elections are not corrupted enough, we're going to soon have the capacity to bet on outcomes. I mean, that is... We're in dangerous territory for like the democracy of this kind of like this is democratizing our dark money system, basically.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's very concerning. I do think there is space for that type of action. There have been state regulators that have been stepping up to some extent to bring actions against these types of companies, and, you know, state attorneys general stepping in to try to essentially take over where the federal regulators are completely dropping the ball. And so, you know, I'm hopeful that we'll see more of that action. There's certainly, I think, plentiful opportunity for civil litigation, although, you know, the outcomes of that are definitely concerning given the sort of sign off that we're seeing at the federal level on these types of activities. I mean, a lot of what these platforms are offering, as I pointed out in a recent piece of mine, it's already explicitly prohibited for them to offer any type of bets on, you know, wars, acts of terrorism, gaming in general is completely off limits in the CFTC regulations. And yet both Polymarket and Kalshi have complete sections, you know, dedicated to sports related events contracts. And so, you know, I think there is an opening there, but it's going to be a challenge, I think.
Well, Molly White, could not recommend a citation needed more. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Quick break, folks, and then we will play for you an interview that I recorded with Greg Stoker from the flotilla just, you know, 3 hours ago. Greg is an anti-imperialist activist, a veteran as well, and we were so lucky to be able to get like a pretty decent connection with him from the flotilla itself. So a quick break, and then we will play that interview for you. We are back, and we are joined now by Greg Stoker, U.S. veteran, anti-imperialist activist, and host of the Colonial Outcast podcast, which is a great show, live with us, or we're recording this a few hours before the show, live with me now, at least, from the global Sumud flotilla, if I'm saying that correctly, sailing to Gaza to break the siege and deliver humanitarian aid. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
I'm so glad to be able to speak with you from the flotilla. As I mentioned, you're on one of the, I guess, 24 boats that set sail on Sunday on the flotilla, trying to get to Gaza to break the siege. But on the other hand, the Israeli government is saying that you're doing this for Instagram clout. So I'm hoping you're taking some cool pics for the timeline, buddy.
I am. The account Quentin Quarantino had a great video of me talking trash to the other journalists who are on like a really nice media boat. And I'm stuck on the vet boat that has like actual sails and rigging. And, you know, it's basically just a massive vacation where we have very limited rations and living space. And we're going to deal with a rogue state that has a history of massacring international humanitarian activists like the Mavi Marmara and the World Central Kitchen last year. But yeah, you know, it's for clout for sure.
Exactly. I mean, obviously incredible bravery by all of you guys, and this flotilla movement keeps growing by the month of people who are trying to join and break the siege. How many folks are with you this time? I know that the ships have delegations from like over 40 countries or something like that.
Yeah, 44 different countries. There's a couple boats from the U.S. delegation. Other countries only have one. But we wanted this to be a transnational effort of humanitarian relief to basically do what our governments collectively as an entire like world population are refusing to do. So, we have had a couple of delays. It actually has gone off. You know, growing up in the military, a lot smoother than I thought it would. You know, from a humanitarian, human rights activist perspective, I thought it was going to be a cluster F than it was. Of course, we had a 24-hour weather stand down, and then we've you know, had to set up a rally point to collect other ships that were scattered in the storm. But we're doing the best with what we can, because this is like a grassroots movement largely. And again, we don't have a military infrastructure. We don't have a tax base where we can, you know, allocate funds to naval operations. So, yeah, there's going to be delays. It's going to take a minute to get there, but we're not going to be deterred through like psychological operations, like Ben-Gvir saying that all of us, including Greta Thunberg, is going to go into terrorist level detention facilities in order to deter other activists for attempting the same thing again. And I would like to remind the minister that there is only one person in this conversation who's actually been convicted of terrorism, Itamar Ben-Gvir.
Good point. Good point. And that brings me to these quotes, because it's insane. This broke yesterday. This is from the Jerusalem Post. The National Security Minister of Israel, Itamar Ben-Gvir, they presented a plan to the cabinet aimed at halting the largest flotilla ever planned to set to sail to Gaza, comprising 50 ships with activists from 44 countries. Ben-Gvir presented the plan in this meeting. Under the new suggested directive, all activists arrested in connection with the flotilla will be detained in Israel's Kenziat and Damon prisons, which are used to hold terrorists under stringent conditions typically reserved for security prisoners. The activists will be held in prolonged detention, unlike the previous practice of releasing detainees after brief overnight stays. Activists will be denied special privileges such as TV, radio, and specialized food. In an effort to impose a clear message that supporting terrorism will not be allowed. So then also Ben-Gvir says they're going to be confiscating your ships and repurposing them under Israeli law. Now, yeah, I'm not a legal expert, but what's their jurisdiction? You're in international waters. Let's start there.
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, I would honestly, Ben, I would love for you to turn these boats that we cobbled together within the past 2 months and use them as your new police force. Because personally, my boat doesn't have bow thrusters, so we can't even dock without port assistance. So please make the new top boats.
They should replace the Israeli Navy or whatever their equivalent is with your guys' stuff. That's my tip for them too.
Yeah, well, see, Ben-Gvir does say a lot of nonsense, but they are definitely concerned. Israel, you know, doing a threat analysis for the Security Council for this Global Samud flotilla, you know, it's easy to find via open source information that Israel has a very small Navy, 49th, 50th largest or smallest, however you want to take that, in the world. They only have 60 vessels, five of which are submarines. Most of them, I would guess, are stationed or posted out in the Persian Gulf to do signal intelligence collection on Iranian assets in the region. Then they have like 6 to 8 like missile cruisers, and then 45 patrol boats, some of which are in patrol detachments based out of the port of Eilat in the Red Sea. So they're not even part of this. So like all other their other naval assets are doing like patrols along the Lebanese and Syrian coast to interdict like weapons or whatever intelligence support going to Hezbollah. So it's like, how many ships and assets do they actually have allocated for this? So what they're hoping is they really don't want to be dealing with this flotilla right now. They're in a bad PR position as it is, you know, as what happens to one who's, you know, enforcing famine and, you know, ethnic cleansing on an entire population, but they don't have any legal basis. So they are falling back on the old tropes of, you know, this is terrorist. This is an act of terrorist. They're calling Greta Thunberg a terrorist. And I would just like to say that, you know, if your state sees a 22-year-old activist as like one of its existential threats, it's not looking good for the longevity of the project. But they're hoping that this will fail. So they're hoping it will collapse in on itself and the entire project will implode before we get to the port of Tunis. That's not going to happen. So we're going to keep moving across the Mediterranean towards Palestinian territories. And in that, there's going to be a lot of psychological operations. So this is kind of like a taste of what we're going to get, these kind of threats. Then it's going to escalate to drones, like holding orbits, close orbits, so you can hear the buzzing all night around the flotilla. We're expecting them to pull tactics like they do with journalists in Gaza, where, you know, they get a ship's captain's phone number, start calling them, issuing threats. We can expect doxing all the way up to having an Israeli Navy Corvette parked off the flotilla, escorting us into an interdiction site. So, psychological operations are going to be a big part of this, and intimidation is going to be a big part of this, because they would like to divide and conquer, break the cohesion of the flotilla so they don't actually have to deal with it, because it's bad information operations all around.
Well, so how many boats are there actually, and how much larger is this flotilla compared to the previous efforts that we talk about, where we saw some of the different sabotage and psychological operations you described, but also there was a last month, I believe, there was acid delivered to one of the boats instead of drinking water. There was damage to the propeller prior to taking off. I mean, this is the Israeli. This is their tactics is written all over it.
Well, we've had more operational security. And look, with an operation this large, you can't really be completely secure. But we haven't encountered acid water or sabotaged propellers or bureaucratic sabotage. They definitely pressured the port authorities to make it so that, like, they denied our insurance, pulled the flags, made it unable for us to launch bureaucratically. And now Isaac Herzog, the president of Israel, is ostensibly flying into Italy today, into Rome today, to meet with the Pope. But I think we assess that that's just a cover for him to add further bureaucratic pressure to the Italian government to deny the launch from the third group of the Samud flotilla that's going to launch out of the Italian peninsula. So, yeah, they're trying bureaucratic, psychological, and then they'll try military. So we've seen through open source intelligence that they've massed a couple of electronic warfare and surveillance planes, C-130s and G-550, converted private jets that have like electronic warfare suites. So they might just try to like burn out all of our comms en route in order to stop the flotilla. I mean, they have a number of ways to do this, but again, it's all a violation of international law.
Of course. Can you speak a little bit about, I know that the dock workers, was it in Genoa, in Italy, have threatened to strike if they lose contact with the flotilla. That is my recollection of that correct? And also, what does that mean to have kind of labor solidarity from dock workers like this backing you?
I mean, it means a lot, but from my perspective, like, it's kind of it's not unprecedented, you know. But my question is, like, why wait? Just shut it down now. I mean, we're like witnessing the final solution and the annihilation of entire people.
Yeah.
And it's kind of frustrating, I'll be honest, to see that people like only really care now that a bunch of like white Europeans are engaged, you know, on a flotilla. Sorry, other boats yelling at us. But that's kind of like why we wanted to do a veteran boat. And that's why I kind of put this thing together last minute, because we wanted to use our protective status due to the like grotesque militarization of our society as veterans to kind of explain to people, or, you know, to make it understandable that whatever violence we do overseas, whatever forms of repression that we enact on other people are almost immediately used upon our own population. And right. That's like, because we have been desensitized to conflicts in the Middle East or West Asia for the past 20 years. It's just what happened over there. You know, the ill-fated and ill-termed global war on terror. It's kind of, I believe, made a lot of people think like, I know it's horrible, but like, what can I do? Or why should I care? It doesn't really affect me. And I think this is why, especially within the context of Israel and operating under the premise that, you know, fascism is on the rise here in the United States, it's so easy to draw a parallel between the Israeli Defense Force and intelligence services and our new extrajudicial Gestapo force, ICE. Because, like, I think The Intercept just broke an article that ICE is now using graphite, you know, developed by the Israeli tech firm Paragon that can basically just infiltrate your entire phone and blow up your contact list and messaging instantly. And now ICE has access to that. And we already know that ICE is basically keeping a database and tracking everybody who posts anything derogatory about them online. So if you're concerned about your own personal safety, we want to make the argument that in some ways, in some very real way, that Palestine is the front line of this struggle, because in the end, whatever our government is willing to do to Palestinians or allow to be done to Palestinians, they're also going to allow to be done to you.
Right. What Greg is referencing there is that ICE is the Trump administration did this deal with Paragon, the Israeli basically, you know, hacking service, and that ICE is going to be able to use it. This has been already used to target activists and journalists in Europe and in other places in the world. And now it seems like the Trump administration is going to try to embrace that here. And I'm sure, Greg, you heard about what the Trump administration just did, bombing that boat off the coast of Venezuela, I believe, and designating them terrorists, which is very much what you're saying. It's like geographically making the war on terror closer, and let alone the tactics being used, like which are torture under international law just towards migrants here in the United States.
Yeah, sorry, I don't know what's going on with my notifications, but yeah, I kind
it's
of
okay.
Oh my god damn, sorry,
it's all right.
Yeah, we're just kind of improvising here, you know,
it's
every day with this flotilla. So yeah, I kind of warned about this, you know, about the law of land warfare back in like November 2023 when they first bombed Al-Shifa Hospital. It's like warfare is kind of like lawfare. It's you need to be really conscious about like what precedents you set and don't set. So now we've set the state bombing of hospitals. Now we have the rampant, just willy-nilly ad hoc designation of different groups as terrorists. So, but that doesn't mean you can't necessarily do anything. But now a precedent has been set. Like, if you have the power, you can do anything with impunity. And of course, you could do that before, but there were norms. There was an interest in maintaining soft power, U.S. soft power around the globe. You know, there used to be a buildup during the Iraq War of manufacturing consent for what we're doing. But now, apparently, we're just going to war with Venezuela. And most people don't understand why. And I think people need to be really concerned when, you know, we, you know, carry out like summary executions on drug traffickers, you know, even if they were, they provided no evidence that, you know, who they were targeting. Usually when I grew up in special operations, if there was a high value target that, you know, was detained or killed in an operation, it was published, you know, not a lot of media picked it up, but you know, that was open source. You could access it. The days of that happening are over. So it's just like, whatever the government says, you know, all these people are like Trendyahuagua guys that are waging a war on drugs against America. Well, how soon before that turns inward on American citizens? You know, when do the drone strikes on Americans or people inside the continental United States who are Trendy de Aragua or MS-13 begin? So again, that's why we're on this boat, because it gives us a platform to actually like talk about it from a veteran's perspective. And it kind of gets like your problematic uncle a little bit more on board with these ideas.
Is that the function you're serving here, right? You can wave the veteran card and then say free Palestine in the same sentence. That works great.
Yeah, well, I mean, we do get accused of stolen valor. So, you know, we're all publishing our DD214s if we have to, which
they seem to throw that around quite a bit. But like back to the flotilla here, we kind of glossed over it, but I mean, I know, of course, you're prepared for detention by the Israeli government, but how are you prepared for that, given the threats that Ben-Gvir is issuing? What is basically the consensus among maybe, you know, your veteran boat, but also the broader flotilla from Greta Thunberg all the way to Greg Stoker?
Well, you know, if they want to, you know, throw a bunch of U.S. veterans doing a action protected by international law into a terror dungeon, you know, all who were honorably discharged from military service, they're fine to deal with that blowback. And, you know, we have systems and support groups in place to blow up our representatives and parallel actions plans. So this is actually a much larger effort than just the boats. There's a lot of planning going in behind this that redounds back to the continental United States and each and every one of those 40 countries that is sending a boat and a delegation.
Were you in communication with the U.S. government at all about your plans in order to have some sort of protection if Israel tries to attack?
Well, I mean, we're eventually going to reach out to the State Department, let them know, you know, that we're out right. there. But again, you know, who's going to be handling our case?
Exactly.
Mike Huckabee.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know that, you know, for example, Greta was in communication with the Swedish government, but it just is, it just underscores what you're doing, that even without an administration that is probably going to heed your call or listen, that this is still something that you guys feel is important, especially with the strength and numbers piece. I mean, this is so much larger than previous efforts. Given Israel's limited capacity on the water, it's a little bit more promising, at least to overwhelm them a bit this time, maybe.
I mean, I'm prepared to get have the whole thing get interdicted, but right. you know, usually what they use for interdiction is their Sayatet 13, which is like their Temu version of Navy SEALs, their Naval Special Operations Unit, and they're very small. There aren't a lot of them. So generally what's been happening is they've been sending a security team to take control of the boats, and then steer them under arms into Ashdod or Haifa. But you know, we have so many vessels, and if we manage to make it there on time, yeah, who knows how they're going to react. And there is actually aid in this convoy. You know, it's not just a PR clout stunt. So, and there are also plans for distributing it and establishing a humanitarian corridor for future flotillas and establishing the precedent that it can be done.
Is that, and when you talk about your mission here, the breaking of the siege and the escalation of breaking the siege with these flotillas continuously coming, being unrelenting and growing in the movement, is that just as important as, you know, the work of hopefully trying to get aid or even, you know, I know that you're likely going to get intercepted, but just the continuing to put pressure on in this way feels like that is just as important as anything, really.
Yeah, it's also we're in an information war for the existential survival of the people of Gaza. And, you know, there's really no way that they can sugarcoat blocking this aid. So that's another pressure point as well that we fully intend to exploit, because it's completely inexcusable. Again, I refuse to exist in a world where we can watch the annihilation of an entire population and just hang out at brunch and try to pretend like everything's fine and like this isn't eventually going to affect me and everybody I care about eventually.
Exactly. And before I let you go, Greg, just your overall assessment of where we are in the movement for a liberated and free Palestine. And your show has been great and focused on this, laser focused on this from the beginning, Colonial Outcast. But you know, we talked about this last time, and perhaps we haven't spoken since, say, like Iran responded and hit Israel in ways that are more severe than their advertising. But I think we did had at one point speak about how Hezbollah had been successful in fighting Israel in southern Lebanon, but then they took a significant blow. It appears like Israel's, you know, military power reasserted itself, but also got into a defensive crouch because of Iran's success. So I'm curious what you feel like from the outside is like your view of Israel's, you know, strength outside of how it's trying to present itself in terms of deterrence.
Well, they can never reestablish their deterrence because that means they would have to achieve a military victory over Hamas or Hezbollah. And or Iran, which none of which is possible. You know, right. they're making efforts to disarm Hezbollah through political machinations in Lebanon. But that's not a military victory. That's not something that's going to deter further aggression, future aggression. Obviously, their own senior disaffected commanders have told publications like Haaretz and Mariv and Ynet News that, you know, the war in Gaza, as the strategic goals are stated, is unwinnable. So, yeah, but in terms, deterrence can't be reestablished. Their edifice, their multi-generational edifice of propaganda and influence within the U.S. government is shattered forever, even though, like, AIPAC still has control in some ways and influence. Like, it's out of the darkness, and it can't last forever now. And so, in terms of the Palestine movement, there just aren't enough of it. of us. So we're trying to preach a doctrine of intersectionality. So this is why I bring in ICE, you know, ICE abolition, prison abolition, environmentalism. All of these things intersect with Palestine. Because it's like the linchpin. It's the linchpin of U.S. imperialism and capitalism.
I think I said it to a friend recently talking about it. It sounds a little corny, but Palestine is the heart of the world right now. And it is the world right now, as far as I'm concerned. And truly, lastly, a little bit more specific on this, the IDF, the calls for reservists, from Netanyahu. I'm curious about your assessment about this, because some apparently just aren't showing up, and there's a lot of talk about fatigue within the IDF or depression because it's quite hard to carry out a genocide, thoughts and prayers. But it appears that they may not have the numbers for his Gaza City ground invasion plans, although the brutality there from the air is still absolutely horrific.
Yeah, of course. But there's not really much left to bomb except the people themselves. A ground offensive would take a lot of men. It would be really grueling. And a lot of these people don't want to be mobilized. That wasn't the deal when they thought when they had to go into the Israeli military. They're going to do 2 years, get out as a specialist, and then go work a tech job in Tel Aviv and live a nice life, like, I don't know, doing whatever they do in Ibiza or some EDM festival. And like, they literally didn't sign up for like a 4-5 year contract like professional militaries do. Like, they weren't mentally prepared for this going into it. And now finally, I believe it was like last year, people were expecting like a higher suicide rate amongst like Israeli soldiers. And as a veteran who like is kind of like active within like veteran suicide circles, it's like it doesn't really happen immediately. You know, you need to give it time to be like, to see these guys being unable to reintegrate back into society after what they've done, unable to hold a job, be in a relationship, you know, like these kind of things have to happen, and that takes time. So not only are reservists not going to be showing up as in the same numbers as they were, but they're going to deal with like a massive suicide rate. And that's only going to get worse the more time that these guys are separated from what they've done or what happened in Gaza and their time in service.
Well, I really appreciate your time today, Greg, from the flotilla, the global Sumud flotilla, sailing to Gaza to break the siege. Everyone can check out Colonial Outcast. I saw you did a podcast from the flotilla as well, so committed to the game.
Yeah, just to make sure that this would work.
Exactly. It gave me a lot of confidence, but I'm so glad to be able to speak with you, and please stay safe. And love and solidarity to everyone on the boats with you. Appreciate you.
All right, thanks for having me on. Cheers, y'all.
Cheers. We are back. We are about to head into the fun half, where we will read your IMs, maybe take a call or two. Very happy we were able to get Greg on the show. And thanks to Matt for getting that one shot with all the flotillas in the background. I mean, incredible, incredible bravery from everybody involved there, and solidarity from here in New York. It is about that time. We're going to head into the fun half shortly. Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning?
Left Reckoning will have another Sunday show for patrons, patreon.com/Left Reckoning this weekend. Check that out.
Check that out. And last night, or two nights ago, was Brian Vokey on.
That's also true. Go check the VOD for the Tuesday night episode if you want to see Brian in the
Brian
flesh.
Brian
Vokey. Bryan Vokey, stand-up comedian, also producer of Majority Report here.
Woo!
And we talked about this elephant graveyard disemboweling, really, of the whole Joe Rogan industry, comedy industry. And I'll talk a little bit about Jimmy Dore and being in the military. So patreon.com/Left Reckoning.
All right. Do we have Binder and Brandon? We do not. All right. Well, we'll head into the fun half and we will see them there. See you on the other side, folks.
Okay, Emma, please.
Well, I feel that my voice is sorely lacking on the Majority Report.
Wait, whoa. Look, Sam is unpopular.
I do deserve a vacation at Disney World. So, ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome Emma to the show.
It is Thursday.
I think you need to take over for
challenge Emma to live like this. And I'll tell you why. So I was offered a tour, sushi, and poker with the boys. Tour, sushi, and poker with the boys. So I was offered a tour, sushi, and poker with the boys.
What?
Tour, sushi, and poker.
Tim's upset.
Tour, sushi, and poker with the boys. So I was offered a tour, sushi, and
ah, that's what we call it, biz.
Tour, sushi, and poker with the boys.
Right.
Tour, sushi, and poker.
We're gonna get demonetized.
I just think that what you did to Tim Pool was mean.
Free speech.
That's not what we're about here. Look at how sad he's become now. You shouldn't even talk about it. I think you're responsible.
Well, I probably am in a certain way, but let's get to the meltdown here.
Tour, sushi, and poker with the boys.
Oh my god.
Tour,
wow.
Sushi.
I'm sorry, I'm losing my fucking mind.
So it's offered a tour, sushi, and poker with the boys.
Logic.
Tour, sushi, and poker with the boys. Boy.
Tour, I think I'm like a little kid. I think I'm like a kid. Tour, I think I'm like a little kid.
Had this debate 7,000 times.
A little kid. I think I'm like a little kid. Think I'm like a kid. Tour.
I'm losing my fucking mind.
Some people just don't understand.
So I'm not trying to be a dick right now, but like, I absolutely think the U.S. should be providing me with a wife and kids.
That's not what we're talking about here. Okay, all right.
It's not a fun job. Tour?
That's a real thing. That's real thing. Real thing.
Willy Wonka.
Tour? That's a real thing. That's real thing. Real thing.
What's that offered?
Tour? That's a real thing. That's real thing. Real thing.
That's
a real thing. That's real thing. Real thing.
What's that offered?
Tour?
Ladies and gentlemen, Joe Rogan has done it again.
That offered?
Tour? That's a real thing. That's
poker with the boy.
I think he might be blowing it out of proportion.
Real thing.
That's poker with the boys.
That offered?
Tour? That's a real thing. That's poker.
Let's go, Joe.
Tour? Sushi and poker with the boys.
Take it easy, Tim.
Tour? Sushi and poker.
Things have really gotten out of hand.
Sushi and poker with the boys.
Delusional.
Tour?
Deluded.
Sushi?
You don't have a clue as to what's going on. Live YouTube.
Sam has like the weight of the world on his shoulders.
Poggers.
Sam doesn't want to do this show anymore.
Can't do it anymore.
It was so much easier when the Majority Report was just you. You were happy.
Let's change the subject.
Right. Rangers and Knicks are doing great.
Now shut up. Don't want people saying reckless things on your program.
That's
now,
one of the most difficult parts about this show.
This is a pro-killing podcast.
I'm thinking maybe it's time we bury the hatchet.
Left is best. Trump. Violet.
Tour.
Don't be foolish and don't fucking tweet at me. Don't get it. The way Emma has cucked all of these people.
Love it.
That's where my heart is, so yeah. I wrote my honors thesis about it.
Oh,
sorry.
She wrote an honors thesis.
Yeah.
I guess I should hand the main mic to you now.
You are to the right of the foreign policy.
We already fund Israel, dude. Are you against that?
That's a tougher question. I don't have an answer to you.
Incredible theme song.
I Bumbler.
Emma Viglin, absolutely one of my favorite people. Actually, not just in the game, like period.
And back.
We are back. It is the fun half, and we have our friends Brandon and Binder. Although Brandon was saying something interesting that people won't be privy to the rest of our conversation, but I actually want to hear your thought. We were talking about, you know, when prisons and these like concentration camps being built up in communities, creating jobs, how hard it is sometimes to like tell people, you know, like people might be like, all right, I don't like it, but I need the job, need the money. You were saying something and I wanted to hear it.
Yeah, no, I was just saying I was watching a segment about Trump's expansion of ICE and the new, like the new mandate that they have, the new powers that they've taken for themselves, you know, extrajudicially, and what they can do with all of the money that they have now that makes them one of the largest military agencies in the world. And I think someone was estimating that they're capable theoretically of detaining almost 100,000 people a day now with all of their resources. And, you know, we're just moving. And I got to say, I really love the interview you did with Greg Stoker just now. Amazing. Definitely re-listen to that if you only joined halfway through like I did, because it was amazing. Real hero. But everything he said was right on point. And that's the end goal of this new police state. That's why we need prison abolition. That's what we need, you know, police abolition, because ultimately what we're looking at is an America where there are only two positions. You are a prisoner or you are a prison guard. And those two positions will be the only things available for you, because we're building the apparatus right now.
That's why it's so frustrating this last 10 years as the Democrats sort of bought into the border panic but didn't take ownership of any of the material spending, which is to say like hiring border guards. And then they're surprised at why Republicans are making gains in southern Texas. It's because they're putting jobs down there.
Well, ICE is also, well, we'll get into this actually, maybe we because I'll send you this article, Matt, and I read it the other day, and that could be a bit of an aside. But hello, you guys. I wanted to give you a chance to plug your shows before we get too into the fun, in quotation marks, of the fun half. Binder, what's happening on your end? And you're muted again. You're muted. You're muted.
Is that better? There we go.
There we go.
Yeah. All right. Just testing you guys.
Yeah, exactly.
just watch Leftist Mafia tonight, youtube.com/MattBinder at 8:30 p.m. Eastern time.
All right. Check it out. And Brandon, what's happening on the discourse?
Yes. So I think next week I'm going to be doing a medley of 9/11 related conspiracy content in honor of the 24th anniversary of 9/11.
And a 9/11 medley. Don't think I've.
How lovely.
Well, yeah, no, a sprinkling. You know, I think a lot of people have not really gone down like the rabbit hole of like 9/11 conspiracy theories. And so, like, you know, I want to cover everything from like Bush did 9/11 all the way down to like there were no towers, there were no planes, they never existed.
Whoa.
And everything in between, which is going to take a while because obviously the 9/11 is, you know, kind of a nexus conspiracy for a lot of people. So we've been doing that. We're going to be doing that, I should say. Of course, we've been enjoying our series, our ongoing series, because there's just so much content of DUI hard, watching police officers be arrested for drunk driving. It's honestly, it's hard to stop. It's some of the freest, most clean content you can watch online.
You sound like you're describing like somebody who's had heroin for the first time, and you're talking about, you're like, it's clean and hard to stop.
Yeah, but it's like, it's that's an interesting dynamic you're describing, because it's almost like that, but I'm addicted to watching someone else be punished for their like alcoholism. So I can't say it's good, but it feels good. So, you know, there are definitely some parallels. It works at a lot of different levels that, you know, I have a hard time fully unpacking on this stream. But join me on the discourse with Brandon Sutton on YouTube and Twitch, and you can help me work through all of my issues.
Emma is dressed like The Rock, says, Brandon, discuss the Israeli Mossad agents who were arrested.
I don't think Emma's dressed like The Rock. Obviously, the most important part of that.
I don't know.
That I am.
Yeah, wouldn't The Rock not be wearing anything? Basically,
I think it's just the gold link chain. But I think it's fresh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I wear this every day.
There was one day that Emma wore it with, I think, a black turtleneck.
No, right. That one.
That was rock coated.
And I went with the chain. I was like, should it be? I went over it, and yes, I was dressed like The Rock.
And she was doing the people's eyebrow, and she was saying, "Do you smell what Emma Vigeland's cooking?"
So it doesn't matter,
Brant. I will. You got to be super excited for Smashing Machine, Bender.
It looks like it might be good. I'm not the biggest Rock fan. I think he's spoiled his all the good graces he had by being a very hard person to work with in Hollywood.
Fair enough.
Yes.
That's especially when you for you.
Especially when you have Batista doing all these great acting roles, and then you have John Cena coming into his own as like a comedic actor. There's really no room for The Rock anymore if he's going to be, a snobby actor.
Gotcha.
Do you think he's going to get the like award consideration for this thing?
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe not. I don't know. You know, I don't know.
I follow this crap, and I gotta say, biopic. Body transformation. It's a Safdie brother directing. It's already doing the rounds at all the festivals. He will get a Best Actor nomination, no question. put all your put don't put any money on
Polymark. Take it to Polymark.
Polymarket. We'll see if he wins. But let's this is relevant to our discussion earlier with Greg Stoker and kind of what you were saying, Brandon, about how our tools of imperialism are basically coming home to the United States, how we're building this infrastructure where there's going to be the capacity for so much incarceration of immigrants, but then political dissidents. And we're at a place where at least right now the administration is building out the capacity for a mass carceral state, even more than the one that we already have as the number one jailer in the world, both I think per capita and also per is it, it
we're
may
not
be
per capita, we're not quite per capita, but in terms of raw numbers we're close per capita. I think occasionally some
numbers.
South American countries might beat us, but in terms of raw numbers we detain more people than China. They have more people than we do,
right? For freedom,
we're working on it.
This article in the Washington Post, it was really disturbing. The Washington Post went to an ICE career expo in Texas, and just listen to some of the quotes from the people that they profiled who showed up. As we know, the Trump administration, via the big ugly ass bill, has exploded the ICE budget by many times over, so that its budget is way larger than, say, the FBI and any other law enforcement agency in the country. And so they have to have a hiring kind of recruitment drive. And some of the people that the Washington Post interviewed some of these people. And scroll up to the top of the article, if you don't mind here, Matt. It opens like this. Christian Osborne has been itching to serve his country since he was discharged from the Marines after refusing the coronavirus vaccine.
Oh my God.
He thinks Americans have a naive view of illegal immigration and wants to be a part of President Donald Trump's mass deportation campaign. Every country for its entire existence has always had borders. We're the only country who says, come on in, says Osborne 24.
I'm stupid.
Okay. There needs to be a control on who can come in to make sure you're not some psycho. Now, we'll just pause for a
second. Says the guy who left the Marines because of coronavirus vaccine.
Right. Yeah. We'll just pause for a second to say, Brandon, you're in Europe. I was just there for my honeymoon. And, I had to transfer in a European country to get to Italy where I was going. And you just see how easy it is if you are like a European person with a passport to go country to country. There were separate lines for it, in part because countries have borders, but we have a heavily militarized one. And that is a policy choice. As opposed to other countries where, they don't see human travel as this like existential threat. Although, of course, the migrant crisis, the backlash to migrants in Europe is horrific, too. But the point is just like the way we operate along our borders is a choice.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The modern and porous nature of borders is just that, incredibly modern. It wasn't until like midway through the 20th century that borders became the way that they are now, or started to become the way they are now, in order to restrict the free movement of people, still allowing the free movement of capital in a lot of situations, which we still do. But prior to that, and especially going back to like pre-nation state, like borders just meant different things because countries or like nations or states were central in like a monarch or like a capital in a more comprehensive way. Like this is just people imagining that the past always looked like the present does in their, again, like in their imagination. And it just doesn't work that way.
Right. And there have been estimates that around 2 billion people by I think 2100 is what the assessment is, are going to be likely in uninhabitable places in the earth, on the earth, that are going to need to migrate, or they could die. So this problem is going to continue to escalate. And right now we have an administration that is quadrupling down on border fascism.
Well, and what is this all a response to? Like, look at what's going on in Europe. These displacements are caused by, in large part, the Western hegemonic foreign policy. Why are people displaced from the Middle East or Northern Africa? Or in our cases, like Venezuela, does it have, look, not to take all agency away from Maduro or whatever, right? We went straight at their number one industry, oil, and gave it a Great Depression. Mm-hmm. And then we're shocked that people are displaced because of it. Like, you know.
Also climate, of course.
Of course. Exactly. Already an issue. And people say, like, act as if it's some come in the future. No, this is already having displacements because of global warming.
It's happening. Absolutely. Bangladesh is, like, projected to lose 17% of its, like, land over the course of the next 25 years by nature of, like, rising water levels. 30% of its, like, agriculture land by nature. And it's only one of just a infinite number, not infinite number, but like every country is having issues like this, whether it's heat, expanded heat domes and longer heat waves and heat streaks, making parts of American Southwest like uninhabitable or projected to be uninhabitable by like a certain projected date, or water rising in Florida. Like, so much of the future is uncertain by nature of how like the climate has been like taken advantage of by our governments and our like large companies.
Well, it's why Naomi Klein and Astra Taylor had that piece where they referred to this movement as end times fascism, where the right understands that we are dealing with things like catastrophic climate change and that our levels of income and wealth inequality are unsustainable and that capitalism is failing in many ways. But you have a guy like Donald Trump, who is nearly 80 years old and looks like shit. And, you know, and these older kind of business people heads who are just going, let me get mine while I'm here on this earthly plane, because that's all, it's fatalistic and nihilistic, as opposed to like, say, like a more aspirational form of nationalism that perhaps previous Republican administrations would harness. This is about enclosing our borders, shoring things up, fortifying ourselves like we're Israel or something, and like both like keeping capital within the hands of the people who are already wealthy. I mean, that's how Trump is designing his economic policy around the tariffs, killing industries that are promising and future oriented, like stuff about around climate, and making sure that we just like oil, coal, all the guys that are rich will add to your pile. That's our central promise. Mm. And the border fascism piece is a part of that. I just want to scroll to the final, like there's a few paragraphs at the end. This guy really struck me, the former MMA fighter, his quote here. They interview a few people, including a man of Mexican heritage who is joining in part because there's a big bonus, five-figure bonuses for these ICE agents. And he's saying he wants to go after the criminals. So he still believes that.
I'm sorry. It's just like when you're describing the background of these people, I'm like, yeah, this is like also the background of like every power slap, like professional slap fighter. It's just like washed out, retired MMA fighter, dude who used to be in the military but had to quit because of vaccines. Like,
yep.
No, it's either these are the only jobs in the Trump economy.
Slap fighter, ICE agent, take your pick.
Yeah. You're the only two jobs. Either way, you're getting brain damage.
These are the type of people where we got going postal from after Vietnam.
Yep. Yep. And
that's who we're recruiting for this.
Listen to this quote here. Reports of rough tactics don't bother Aaron Eli either. A former bantamweight MMA fighter who went by the ring name The Cyborg, Eli settled on an IT career after his hip gave out. He limped into the hiring expo last week, hoping ICE could use his computer expertise. He said he felt he was no longer able to advance in the private sector because the market is crowded with candidates from India willing to do work for less. I keep seeing these memes where Indians are bragging about taking our tech jobs, said Eli, 36. So I said, oh yeah? Well, I'm going to work with these guys that are going to arrest you, slam your face on the pavement, and send you home. So when we're talking about how difficult it is to combat, say, the construction of ICE concentration camps or private prisons in communities that have been left behind in this country, redder rural areas where there's very little economic opportunity. You can see basically why that kind of selling point by fascists is so difficult to combat, because we don't have an opposition party that's talking about redistributing wealth in a way that would combat these problems.
Or who the villain is in that situation, right. Which is the capitalists. Yeah. And I got news for him. All the Silicon Valley guys who you're worried about using Indian labor to undercut wages here at home, they've already got, they're taken care of still. Like the first, in the lame duck, Elon Musk and Trump were saying, actually, we're going to still do the H-1B visas. Like, but you're not being, like,
yeah, like
the actual issue here isn't going to be solved by you supposedly inflicting violence on the workers.
Right. But also, like, does he not realize that all those Indian tech workers are here on H-1B1? Like, they're here. They're not who ICE is going after.
Well, I mean, they might be. I mean, they're revoking. Yeah, yeah. They're going after legal immigrants, too. His motivation is one of racism. So he's, well, like, the perfect fit for that. But it's also, like, Hitler understood giving young men employment opportunities within the Nazi Party to engender a level of loyalty when the economy wasn't working for them. And what really scares me about this ICE recruitment is that we're seeing the economy collapse. We have, like, the worst job numbers that are coming out since April 2021 at this point. Yesterday, it was announced that there are more unemployed people than job openings for the first time since April 2021. Inflation due to the tariffs is exploding, and it's going to keep getting worse towards the end of the year. And I think the administration fundamentally understands that it functions as a regressive tax, and so we will provide opportunities with our Gestapo recruitment effort, and that is how fascism works.
Absolutely. And just to jump in quickly, like, it even predates Hitler. In the, you know, when slavery was still, law in the South and in America, they used to encourage, like, poor whites who could not afford to own their own slaves to rent slaves for the day, to rent slaves for, like, you know, short periods of time, to be able to play slave owner in such a way that would help them feel like the gap between them and richer white people was, like, you know, being shrunk, right? Because that is, like, one of the promises of these ethno supremacist hierarchies, that, like, yeah, you may not be at the top with the other rich white people, but we can make you feel like, you know, you at least have a permanent underclass, which makes you feel like the gap between the upper class of whites who are, you know, using this hierarchy just to their advantage. You can at least feel like you have something more in common with them than you do with the people on the bottom, which you have infinitely more in common with. So this is as American as apple pie, because it's been a way to, like, divide the working class for, you know, as long as there's been a capitalist class. We needed to divide the working class.
Imagine if there was apps in 1850. There'd probably be an app where you could rent a enslaved person from a plantation owner, and that's America.
Slave Dash.
I mean, we're not far. I mean, like, truly,
working our way backwards.
DoorDash and that kind of stuff.
Did you see the video?
Bringing stuff to you, like, at your beck and call.
That's what rich people have
all the time. But hey, you got it on your phone.
See that video where it was a compilation of delivery drivers having to run from dogs and people being like, "Ha ha, this is funny."
It makes me sick.
It's disgusting.
Remember when we had that flash flood a few months ago, and I saw, like, some stupid, like, New York City culture account I follow just, like, to keep up with the city posted, like, NYC delivery drivers built different, because this guy was motoring through water up to his shoulder blades. I'm like, this isn't, like, a quirky function of New York City. This is, like, absolutely horrific that people feel like they have to go through these conditions without any protections from their companies. These are all gig workers to deliver food to people. Give me a break.
Yep. The service worker economy is part of that same, you know, that same idea, right? That you may have to take crap from your middle manager at your desk job in some office or some remote from home situation, but at least you get to give that, you know, that same amount of shit to a service worker. You get to rent being the manager for some person, you know, and where you can give them that same amount of, like, you know, at least imagined grievance, and it makes you feel better. Like, it's a sadomasochistic system that gets people to, like, imagine that they have to give people who are coming up the same amount of, you know, garbage they feel like they've gotten.
Right.
All right.
Sage Sunday, the MMA guy talking about always seeing memes about Indians taking jobs is exactly how the algorithm works to radicalize us. Have you ever seen a meme like that? I haven't, and I work
no
in
idea
IT.
What he's talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly. Yeah, remember, they're all telling on themselves with the, like, my feed are all black guys fighting white people. It's like, because you're not, algorithm is for Nazis. Congrats.
Yeah, you're on the Klan algorithm. I mean, it is shocking. Like, I can't even imagine what that content looks like, where it's like an Indian guy being like, haha, American, I'm coming to take your IT job. Like,
yeah.
Actually, if people have seen that stuff, I'd like to see an example of it.
Okay. Shoot, where did my IMs go? Oh, small D Democrat. Does the guy know the Indians taking the jobs are usually way over there in India? Yeah. Right.
Well, I mean, the problem with the H-1B visas thing is they're allowed to be over here, but not given citizenship or any of the protections of being an American would entail, and basically kept under control of bosses. That's the problem with H-1B visas. Anybody who is working for a capitalist, in my opinion, in America, should have immediate citizenship. But it's like this sort of halfway measure where, and I don't like liberals that pretend like that's an immigration program. It's not an immigration program. It's a bonded labor program.
Yeah. Moody Apolis, an America where there's only two jobs, prisoner and prison guard. Brandon always comes through with bars. Very true. Sam's garbled syntax. Honestly, I don't know why the IDF doesn't bomb the flotilla. Would anyone blink at this point? I mean, yes, yeah, because there are 40 people from 44 different countries whose government may not be as fascistic as ours right now.
But that said, like, I'm still, like, in the back of my mind, every time this has been, they've been interdicted, I'm concerned about it.
Me
because,
too.
I mean, the way they detained Smalls last time, like, they're... All it takes is one Israeli to decide, like, oh, my finger's itchy, and they'll excuse it.
I think we have to admit, and I think this is just part of, like, the way in which the West normalizes its own politics and politicians, that Israel is a rogue state that is being led by a religious zealot. And that means they're very dangerous and very unpredictable. They've been framed by our media as being a predictable, rational, democratic actor in the Middle East, but they aren't that. We can see that they aren't that. So, it's, I think, perfectly reasonable to not know what they might do. But I do think that there is still a rational faction within Israel, which understands that if they were to do that, the way the tide is turning amongst a lot of countries in, like, Western Europe and, you know, just around the world, it might be the thing that allows for Western European countries to start disaggregating themselves from Israel, just, like, totally, without, like, coming across as being too pro-Muslim or too pro this. So it might give a lot of countries that have been, like, let's be honest, just stalling until the genocide is over, the excuse to, like, go, like, hey, yeah, we're against this. We're actually always been against this. So, I mean, I think it would be a very dangerous proposition, but they're a very dangerous country.
Yeah. Also, gotta say, guys, we tried with the phones. We're still having the same issue today as apparently was happening yesterday. So,
well, it's a slightly different issue, so, which is always fun.
Yeah,
like variety.
But more time for clips. El Canipsion, thanks for turning me on to Greg. I listen to Colonial Outcast regularly. They are heavily shadow banned. It's a great show. Tom Cotton's Beard, thank you guys so much for talking to Greg. He's a treasure. If you haven't yet, everyone should check out Colonial Outcast. Yes. Mayada, mutual aid fundraiser for families under direct threat of forced displacement from the north to south, spot.fund/directaid. Okay, thank you for sharing.
We're looking at a pretty grim century when you look at the countries that are most affected by global warming versus the countries that are most responsible for global warming, and Yeah, it turns out that the countries that are most responsible for it aren't going to be the most affected. It's all going to be between the meridians.
Right. Charlie Jerk, congratulations to David Pakman on finally having his "Why I Left the Left" moment yesterday. I mean, I wouldn't go that far, but we'll cover that in just a second.
Oh, I don't know what's going on. I gotta know.
We'll play it. I just want to get through some more IMs here. Nate's Silver Sweaty Abacus, Emma, who do you have winning each division in the NFL this year? Oh, geez. All right, all eight off the top of my head. I can give a
do ESPN right now.
Yeah,
there are NFC... eight divisions in it.
Yeah.
How are you thinking about the NFL right now when
four in each? Well, let me see if I can rattle this off really quickly. Houston Texans, AFC South, Chiefs, AFC West, obviously, Bills, AFC North, AFC East, obviously, Ravens, AFC North, Eagles, NFC East, Packers, I'm going to say NFC North, Rams, NFC West, Bucks, NFC South.
She was offered a tour. Sushi and poker with the boys.
Although maybe the Falcons, but I need to see a little bit more from Penix, although I'm very excited about it. See, I did that really quickly, guys.
Did the season even start
amazing.
Yet?
It starts tonight. It starts tonight. And I'm gonna I don't miss think it I can name
that many teams.
Yeah.
I'm going to miss the opening of the season, and I think I'm going to miss Sunday, too, because I'm my lovely sister-in-law, who I adore, but it's her bachelorette party this weekend, so I will not be in tomorrow. That's me also announcing that.
Mm.
This is why you guys don't get invited places.
I know.
On the contrary, she was invited somewhere. That's why won't be here tomorrow.
Former libertarian says, per your interview earlier, the language about moving Palestinians out to build a Riviera is pretty similar to Vance saying we're going to move out undocumented migrants to improve housing. Yeah, it's all ethnic cleansing language.
I mean, it's the Nazi playbook of scapegoating a minority you can demonize to protect capitalism. Yep. I mean, it's just crazy how it's just the same exact shit.
Yeah.
I feel like people are even forgetting about Trump's, I'm sorry, just quickly to cut Trump like saying that he's going to start like forcefully committing unhoused people. That like, you know, as the homeless population increases, they're just going to be like forcefully committing them, likely in some of these same prisons that are being built for, like right now to house undocumented migrants.
Yep.
Well, and that's the other thing is like we went on this mass incarceration spree, you know, 20, 30 years ago. A lot of the prison population is aging out, dying in prison, including, you know, a lot of the political prisoners from those periods. That's a problem when you rely on that for your economy.
Yeah.
And they're literally instead of saying, OK, let's figure out how to wind down mass incarceration, they're figuring out how to keep that industry of caging humanity going.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's because it's how you make someone who is not productive because they are unable to work for one reason or another. Maybe there's just not enough jobs. It's how you make them productive within our capitalist system. You put them in a private prison where they can be enslaved as, you know, replacements for undocumented labor. And you can use that, you know, excuse for them being behind bars to funnel money to the private prison industry. Like it's a win-win-win.
And here's another win is you get to take the people from urban areas and cage them in more rural areas and count them on the census for representational purposes in the rural areas.
Holtenheim says, Emma's mind is truly built different. It is a little weird. I get it. But appreciate that. How do you say this guy's name? Is it David Pakman?
I don't even know how to say it.
David Pakman? Anyway, here, let's play this.
This is David Pakman responding to the Taylor Lorenz reporting.
Some creators in the first 48 hours took the Wired story and expanded it with even more outrageous claims, suggesting that it's AIPAC or IPAC. I don't even know how it's pronounced.
IPAC,
that is funding this show
man.
Or other creators. Of course, not true.
Can you go back a little bit?
I, I don't even know APAC or IPAC. I don't even know how it's pronounced. APAC. Hmm. IPAC.
Just play it one more time.
With even more outrageous claims, suggesting that it's APAC or IPAC. I don't even know how it's pronounced. APAC.
Whoopsie.
IPAC. That is funding this show or other creators. Of course, not true.
Oh, he's got to be joking. He's got to be doing some sort of dry humor bit there. I refuse to believe he doesn't know how
shot is pronounced. Shot there, Bender. Shot. Now chaser. I bring you.
It's a funny joke.
It was a good joke. Hopefully it was a joke. I bring you this montage that many wonderful social media users, who is this person here? Full Slack went back into the archives. All you got to do is probably Control F APAC. Here it is 6 years ago talking about Ilhan Omar.
APAC from APAC. APAC support APAC. APAC.
Okay. So
I mean it has to be just a joke. I mean
yeah.
What?
Not a good
it's
one.
It's not a joke. It's not
Hackman
a joke.
Doesn't joke. He doesn't have a sense of humor. This is what's fascinating to me about this though is what he says before, which is he's threatening lawsuits about this stuff.
Yeah.
Implying that the Wired article is like so defamatory and huge problems with it. He called it fully debunked in what I would call a Trump-like turn of phrase.
Oh, that was that statement that was like copy and pasted by a bunch of creators calling it wholly and fully debunked or something like that when not a single thing about it has been debunked. It's
no,
the article is still up in full, unchanged, on no corrections. The article by Taylor Lorenz in Wired is legit.
And the thing that's telling in this thing here, Pacman says, and I'm just gonna play the audio here. Listen to what he says.
The first 48 hours took the Wired story and expanded it.
So that is slimy, what David Pacman did right there. Because he doesn't address ever, and none of these people do, the Wired story and the thing that's wrong with it. What Pacman does right here is moves on from that.
48 hours, took the Wired story and expanded it with even more outrageous claim.
I don't know anybody who said explicitly David Pacman is taking APAC money.
No.
People were concerned about the money from Chorus he wasn't disclosing.
Right.
The only thing people said about Israel at all is that Pacman has a major blind spot in the issue, which is evident by the fact that he either sincerely, jokingly, or is a lie, acts like he doesn't know how to pronounce APAC. Right. That is disqualifying. The Democrats should not be paying anyone.
Also,
whether they disclose it or not, who doesn't know how to pronounce fucking APAC in 2025? They're their top five PAC spender in our elections, David. Do you care about elections?
Right. Yeah. Well, also, we should say that, you know, I personally don't believe that David Pacman took any sort of guidance on his content from Chorus because he didn't need to. David Pacman was already not covering what's happening in Gaza well before Chorus even came into the picture. Chorus didn't have to tell David Pacman not to cover Gaza. He was doing that himself on his own.
Yeah, well, it's a chicken or the egg situation, right? Where it's like, did Chorus, and by the way, Chorus is the group that is essentially the middleman in between the dark money billionaire-backed fund, which we do not know where that is coming from, the 1630 fund, and the creators. So yes, it does have a public-facing element to it where they also recruit some of these people to sign up. But what was unearthed by Taylor Lorenz's reporting, again, gone over by Wired's editors, by their lawyers. This is a paper that has published stories that have been unimpeachable about very serious topics about the Trump administration, including them editing out minutes of footage of Epstein's cell, including Doge's activities. They have to protect themselves legally. And they did so not just in their critical reporting of the Trump administration, but they did so in this case as well. And I'd encourage people to listen to Taylor went on the Vanguard yesterday, and I was listening to a bit of it. And, you know, she speaks about her history of reporting on libs of TikTok. I think she did a lot of critical reporting on Charlie Kirk, and she focuses on the influencer space in the political realm broadly. And none of these folks had anything to say back when she was covering these like Republican influencers in these this incredibly critical way. But now all of a sudden they're going to use these same Trumpian tactics against her. And it you know, there's a part of the story at this point that has an update, which is basically like the lawyer writing in and saying like, hey, you know, this is our statement on it, but it didn't alter the substance of the story whatsoever. So this is what I meant to say. What Taylor mentioned in her interview with the Vanguard guys was like that, I guess Brian Tyler Cohen has accused her of being in league with Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson, like, and his harassment of her and obsession with her led to the doxing of her and her family. And she speaks about that there. Like, oh, this is not somebody who is in league with Republicans. I mean, Taylor is, before this story, was known as one of the Republican boogeymen who focus on her in this way. One, because she has a personality online, and she even admits, like, sometimes I can be a little bit crazy on Twitter or whatever, but I have views and I'm open about it in ways that other reporters conceal and pretend to be robots in public. At the very least, you know where Taylor stands on all of this stuff. And her reporting history is fairly unimpeachable on these right-wing influencers and on this. And so it's really disgusting, in my view, to see these kind of Democratic influencers basically using fake news and these Trumpian tactics on media figures that they don't like instead of just owning up to this kind of thing.
I saw that clip that they used where it was Candace Owens and what's his face? Tucker Carlson talking about Taylor Lorenz. And they very sarcastically said something, very tongue-in-cheek said something about her. So obvious they weren't promoting her. They were knocking her. And that was the clip that they used to say that she was, like, on their side and they like her and is in, like, they're all in bed together. It was ridiculous.
Dishonest smear of the messenger. It's literally ad hominem. And they don't address, like, again, any of the claims about, like, the contract conditions. They just say, oh, well, those aren't enforced, which, I mean, please. And this idea that, okay, some of the creators you've never heard of that were taking this stipend were critical of the DNC in this way or, you know, said something in support of Gaza. I wonder if they would have after the full incubation period.
Mm.
You know, like I'm sorry, I don't credit that. I don't think that's that impressive to me when those terms are what they were. And this thing about like they need to give a heads they just need to give a heads up to Chorus. Remember when Olivia Giuliana couldn't find an opinion, anything to say about Zoran, and she's like, oh, I haven't looked into this yet. Do we think this had nothing to do with the Chorus thing?
Yeah.
Of course, I mean, I'm not saying it definitely did, but I'm sorry, when I see a contract that said we need to clear certain things with us, and one of the lead Gen Z influencers saying they haven't been following this Zoran thing and don't have an opinion about it, that seems to me like, oh, they signed a contract and they are awaiting what to say. That's the appearance that it gives.
The guidance. And the reality is that this space is deeply underregulated and there is like very little oversight or understanding. Bless you. There's very little transparency about where this money is coming from. And I'd imagine that this is just the tip of the iceberg of the kind of funds that are pouring into some of these internet media sources, because I think especially really 2020 on, companies realize, and there's been an explosion in podcasts popularity, there's even more and more, and the pandemic supercharged this, where they realize like, hey, we can take out ad space on some of these podcasts for really cheap. Why don't we start to pour money into this? And there's really no oversight on this front. So first comes advertising money. Then in the political podcast realm comes dark money. And everything is pay to play right now in our social media ecosystem because the chains are off. You're pumping these like controversies that are completely manufactured, like the Sydney Sweeney jeans thing or the Cracker Barrel logo that no one in real life cared about, but social media was telling you that you cared about it. It's because this is like information warfare, and we have probably very little understanding right now of all of the money behind trying to get this stuff to the top of the algorithm and gaming it that way.
No, absolutely. Right. And just 2 points to what you and Matt were both saying. The first, I think we have to acknowledge that a lot of more liberal aligned pundits and more like liberal leaning politicians actively use the corruption, the greater and more naked and oftentimes more clumsy corruption of the Republican Party to justify what they consider to be their like lesser magnitude corruption, you know. And David Pakman makes that point there when he highlights AIPAC, right? He draws the comparison between the dark money he's taking and a more problematic, obviously more problematic, dark money group AIPAC, or a lot of what they do is out in the open, to be honest, but they have problems other than whether how secret it is. But the reality is that just empowers the far right. Like engaging in the same type of corruption, engaging in the same kind of like naked corruption just allows for people who are disillusioned from, you know, from politics already to go, like, you see, it is all the same, which is partially what they're doing. But it's something that we have to acknowledge is a fundamental flow of lesser evilism, that you have people who are in like these liberal aligned spaces who look at how evil or how corrupt Republicans are and actively only try to be slightly less evil than they are. They don't try to be good. They just go like, well, I'll just be like slightly less bad than they are. That being said, I am very willing to take dark money from any group that is willing to give it to me. However, I am not willing to agree to make any concessions to the things that I say, not because of moral courage, but because of impulse control problems. So if we can make that deal and stick to it.
Yeah. And I just want to say, too, that like the part of why this is such a betrayal is that the independent media space was supposed to be and sold to folks. One, I think Pakman describes himself as independent, if I'm not mistaken.
He puts that in his marketing for sure.
It's described as something that's basically outside of the perverting elements of the mainstream media here, that's where
the value proposition,
where I'm just responsible for you, and you have like the trappings of independent media, or the way that it's presented indicates that
member supported.
But
it's
in fact,
you.
It might actually be worse than a lot of some of our more established media standards that have been in place for a while. I mean, say what you want, of course, about the mainstream media and all of that, but there is at least like Chris Hayes isn't determining what ads are going on his show, right? And there is a like, or even CNN, yeah, there's issues with like if you step over the line too much and you piss off an advertiser, you might have a meeting with the CEO and that's an issue, but that's not determining your day-to-day coverage. I'm sorry, that's just not how it works there. You're getting a money from a Democratic affiliated dark money group? Are you serious?
Right.
That, you know, like that's direct, and it's also you're not being transparent. If you have an advertiser, you read the ad.
Right.
Yeah.
But to me, like the ability. No, go ahead. Go say what you were gonna say.
I was going to say, yeah, and it erodes people's ability to like critique money in other groups, because this is something that we have an issue with. And it's not just limited to like, you know, pundits online. Democrats and Republicans both engage in this sort of myth making that taking money from groups doesn't impact the way you behave. And that is not something you should teach people, because it is not true. But it seems like it can be true when you're getting that money and you want to imagine that it's not impacting the way you behave.
Right. It's self-flattery.
But to me, like the story, Taylor Lorenz's story was obviously a well-reported story, and it obviously was significant in, you know, in online political influencer circles, political creator circles. But like overall, like the story itself didn't have like much legs to me outside of like obviously it was impactful, but it wasn't going to be something that would have, you know, ruined these people's careers if they handled it correctly. To me, the craziest thing is the reaction. Like how easy it would have been for the creators, the chorus to come out addressed the situation, put out a statement saying, you know, we're going by the usual sort of, you know, I guess influencer sort of way of looking at things, but we really should treat ourselves like journalists because that's how our audience looks at us as they come to us for news. We, you know, we might disagree with some parts of her reporting, but this is how our creators felt based on, you know, who she spoke to or the chat log she saw. And we're going to, you know, change how we do things here and work to be more transparent. It would have been super simple. Story would have been over. No one would be talking about it anymore, you know, outside of certain circles. But instead, they lied. They lied over and over again about details in the story, about it being debunked, about Wired correcting it or something like that. I saw people arguing over Wired correcting the story when they never did. The story is exactly what was published with additions to the story as more information came in that did not change the actual reporting at all. And they lied to their audience about it. To me, like, the first thing is forgivable. Some of these creators are new to the scene.
Yep.
They're fairly young, some of them. They're learning. They admit they made a mistake and they correct from the mistakes that they learned about from this reporting and they do better. That would have been that. But instead, they lied. For me personally, if I was the audience of any of these creators who went on record and lied about the story, I would never be able to trust these people again. They
and
lied.
Pac-Man was already established. Pac-Man was already so established that is where it's a little bit more difficult, I think. As I had an interaction, you know, kind of debating this a little bit back and forth with Jon Favreau of PodSave, respectfully, but I basically was saying that kind of same point there, Binder, where it's just like, if you're a younger creator and they're probably not getting the max of $8,000 a month, they might be getting like $500 a month, and they, you know, they maybe don't have a big following. You can see, like, they don't have the infrastructure almost to say no to that kind of thing. But when you're like Juliana or Pac-Man or somebody that's already has a big platform, I just think it's pretty indefensible. Singing to the Chorus writes in, is there any chance TYT knew about these contracts and that's why they accuse MR of the supposed Kamala ads?
Nah.
It's an interesting theory.
Nah,
I'm
making shit up.
Well, I mean, yeah, I guess the only reason I would say it's there's some way to it maybe is just because I know that that when they might have some Democratic Party contacts from the time they sold their email list to the Biden campaign in 2020.
I mean, why they would think that we would take this, I mean, you have to be
projection.
Cuckoo. The Pac-Man thing, and Binder is right, like, this is, the response has been shocking.
Yeah.
Just call it fully debunked. Again, that is a Trump-like attack on the press.
Oh, and I'm sorry, Matt, but just to say, Pac-Man's threatening to sue Taylor.
Psycho.
That is Trump-like and yep. messed up. Taylor gets enough abuse online, and I don't care if people don't agree with me on this. If you're a man, if you're Hunter S. Thompson, if you're like Glenn Greenwald from 10 years ago, you get to be somebody who's like opinionated on the internet, maybe have some opinions people don't agree with, you know, maybe piss some people off, and people don't write you off your credibility or micro focus on maybe some of your flaws in the way they do for Taylor. There have been like years and years of misogynistic attacks against her, and the fact that I see some people on our side engaging in this is despicable to me. Go ahead, Matt.
Sue Wired. Good luck, David.
Yeah, good. Do it.
Because this let me get this out quick.
Yeah.
This thing about this fully debunked. Guess what paragraph still exists untouched on this as I read it right now. The contracts reviewed by Wired prohibit standard partnership disclosures, declaring that creators will not publicize their relationships with Chorus or tell other members of the program without Chorus's express prior consent. A screenshot from the slideshow, blah, blah, blah. They also forbid creators from disclosing the identity of any funder and give the Chorus the ability to force creators to remove the correct content based solely on the organization's discretion if that content was made at a Chorus organized event. Just to finish that, because I did go over a screenshot from the slideshow that was shared with Wire. This is what they were talking to about a supposed correction, which was really just addition by a subject who reached out after this story got probably more attention than they were expecting it to. But a screenshot from a slideshow was shared with Wired following this article's publication by Graham Wilson, a lawyer working with Chorus, offers several talking points if a member of the cohort wanted to discuss Chorus publicly. But I'm sorry, a slideshow is different than what's in the text of the contract that you made people take or leave without letting their lawyer see it. Like, that's insane. You any kind of contract like that is fucked up in this business, and it not only makes you look bad, it also casts aspersions on all of us, like we said with TYT making those allegations. They've just ramped this up. Now Tim Pool can say, oh, you're probably taking Dem money. Right. You probably, who cares? The nihilism here by these people, and to act like this is about winning power or saving the world, it's about putting money in your fucking bank account.
Right. Matt hit the broader thing there perfectly, but also I want to just focus on what would Pacman sue Taylor Lorenz over? Like, I looked at this, and when I heard someone told me he was threatening to sue her, like, what she says about him is indisputable because she clearly has his name in the proof. Like, there's that whole article that Matt just basically broke down some of the bigger parts, but Pacman is only named in a section with other influencers as influencers included in communication about the program, and in some cases, an onboarding session for those receiving payments from the 1630 fund. So unless Pacman has some sort of proof debunking Taylor Lorenz that he wasn't in these communications that Taylor has, which she wouldn't include his name if he didn't, then what is he going to sue her over? Like, she doesn't.
She has screen recordings. She has the group chat. She can't publish the exact contract, which is what like these streamer brain idiots are saying, because they've never read a New York Times piece before that doesn't sometimes publish actual documents because they have to summarize them to not out their source. This is standard journalism, including the difference between a correction and an update. And either people are being disingenuous, or they don't have the media literacy to understand this, and I'm not sure which one is a worse problem. Matt has an appointment, so I'm going to read some IMs and get out of here. Sorry about that, guys.
No, it's all good. I mean, we can't keep talking about this for an hour more.
Nate Silver's sweaty abacus. Pretty neat how Pacman and all the other creators in the Wired article have gone with the Clarence Thomas defense regarding Harlan Crowe. They just like what I do and me as a person. Please think no further on this. Luke from Oregon, live from the 1630 Chorus Studio. Dave from Jamaica, Matt Binder is correct. Even Taylor herself said the reaction to the story shocked her.
Hit dogs hollering is the phrase that people are using.
Karl Marx, I'm embarrassed by you guys ignoring the most important international and moral issue of our generation. Pacman losing a few dozen subscribers.
Fundraising opportunity, though.
Singing to the chorus. As reported by Nathan J. Robinson on Twitter, Pacman's brother, who's a producer on the show, was a regional director for the ADL.
That's true.
It's not APAC money, but Dave's love of the game. Still, I will forever call him David APAC.
To be fair, David was mispronouncing APAC as IPAC like 13 years ago. So I think there might be some sort of anxiety about... I think he's lying about not knowing how to pronounce it, but...
Yeah.
Weird. Weird stuff going on.
Dan from Columbus, I watched Hassan covering APAC Man and pulled up the Pacman Reddit for the post saying that it could look the other way about the Wired article, but this was disqualifying. Pacman responded, basically, I mispronounce stuff all the time. It's no big deal. Here's a list of other words I can't pronounce. Theo Bong, courses like Tenant Media, they didn't pay them to make specific content. They paid them because they liked what they were saying and wanted to subsidize their message.
Yep.
Kyle Leck, IPAC, what is he talking about? The International Particle Accelerator Conference? Three more. Fratter 12, the name is too cool for something so tawdry. Really dark money should include portraits of undead presidents.
It's a sick idea. Yeah, I like that. Yeah,
the abortion nurse. That abortion nurse. I'm middle-aged, so I remember a time when respected and ethical reporters used to go to jail to protect their sources. I don't think people now know the difference between actual reporters and commentators. Commentators are important and can help provide commentary. But as a reporter with an impeccable record and working with a respected news organization, it is an important source of facts.
Yep.
When they call her a liar, they help the Republicans with their crusade to discredit facts.
To protect their own venal interests.
It's the same reason, like, someone will call me a journalist on Twitter or something like that. I am not a journalist. I am not a journalist. Journalists do incredible, important work. I'm a commentator. That's very different. And the final IM of the day. congressional baseball fan. I keep hearing we have to fight fire with fire, which apparently is okay if you're taking dark money from a political party, but not okay if you tell people to work on their fastball. Well said. All right, guys. Appreciate you all. Thank you so much. I will be out tomorrow. I'm going to this bachelorette party. I don't really know anyone else there, so wish me luck. But actually, it's actually a lot of pressure off. I'll just be able to chill and meet new people.
Go wild.
Oddly, it would be worse if I knew of people there, but it'll be fun. I will see you on Monday. Sam will be back tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and